All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Preston, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Trey, and I'm an alcoholic.
And tonight, I'm going to introduce the speaker. We've been trudging this road a few years together, and I'm just going to throw out a good definition of insanity. Me, Daryl, and Pierce, we do a lot of traveling together. The first trip we made together, we went to Jazz Fest in New Orleans. You know, we're having a good time, and Pierce gets this call, and then, you know, after the call, we see he's got his long face, and we said, "What's wrong, Pierce?" And he's like, "Man, they fired me." I'm like, "Damn, that sucks, dude. Don't worry about it right now, man. Well, you know, we know how to do this, man. We're just going to trudge right through it. We're going to get to the other side. You'll get another job. God's got your back." He did. He got another job. We came back. He got another job. We go on another trip, deep sea fishing trip, me, Daryl, and Pierce. He gets a call. I was like, "What's wrong, man? Did you get fired or something?" "Yeah, man, I got fired." "Shit, dude. Well, we've been through this one. Let's just get up, go fishing, and we'll figure this out when we get back to Atlanta." You know, we did. We fished. We had a good time. We come back to Atlanta, and he's a go-getter, man. He'll go straight to the library, and he'll hunker down, and he gets another job. So next time, we're in Puerto Rico. Me, Daryl, and Pierce. And he gets a call. Didn't even have to ask him. We knew what the deal was. But, you know, he's someone that I've seen. He goes through this with dignity and grace. I've only seen this given the people that come in that have been through what we've been through going through the 12 steps. He's a great friend of mine, and I give him Pierce tomorrow.
Hi, my name is Pierce, and I'm an alcoholic. And that was quite the introduction. And I can add on to that. So, my sobriety date is June 10, 2010, so I've just managed to celebrate 9 years of sobriety. You know, that is a grace from God and the company I keep. You know, my mother always said, you know, "Show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are." I look around this room, I see a lot of my friends. You know, a lot of people in my home group here. A lot of, you know, I got a lot of texts today. I got a lot of calls. You know, basically, Pierce, I can't make it, but, you know, break a leg or whatever, you know. And that means a lot to me, you know, because when I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I showed up pretty beaten up. You know, there's some people in this room tonight that were here when I got here. And, you know, they'll give testimony to it if you need it. You know, I came in basically friendless, brokeless, moneyless, jobless. And, you know, and I have all those things today, you know, and that's not the life that you know, that I lived most of my life. Most of my life, basically, I was a shucker and a jiver, a hustler, and, you know, I remember I used to tell people, "If you're going to hang out with me, it's going to be expensive, you know, so don't come without money, you know." So, you know, I'm supposed to tell my story, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I was born to two poor sharecroppers in the Bronx. No, I was born and raised in the Bronx. I grew up there until I was 21 years old. The Bronx was an interesting place to grow up. You know, it was, you know, you had to be a tough guy. You had to be, you know, on your game constantly because people are always trying to take you down. And to this day, I still, you know, have that fight in me. You know, and I'll tell a story about just recently what happened where, you know, I'm doing some crazy stuff. But, you know, so my drinking started relatively early. I started drinking probably when I was 10 or 11 years old. My father died when I was 11. And the first time I remember really drinking was my older brother's 10 years older than I am. He decided to take me camping. And so we're driving into upstate New York, you know, and there's a six-pack of warm Rheingold on the floorboard of his car. And, you know, he's like, "Oh, no." You know, he goes, "You know, you want a beer?" I'm like, "Yeah." And, you know, and the thing was, he says, "Well, here, let's get him cold and we'll drink him later," right? So we ended up basically getting him cold. And I remember drinking those beers. And I don't know how many I had, but I remember we were in an inflatable raft and we were in a whirlpool. And I was, it was really the first time in my life I was ever able to sleep. I remember just, you know, feeling that calmness and warmness that comes over you. And, you know, if you would ask me, you know, 10 years ago, I'd have no recollection of it. You know, it's amazing how your memory gets better the longer you've been sober. So my drinking started relatively young. When I was in eighth grade, I broke my leg. And so you have an eighth grade graduation. And so my friends went to the VA hospital and they stole a wheelchair so that if I got drunk, I wasn't on my crutches. You know, so this was, you know, people ask what it was like growing up in the Bronx. It was kind of like the Bowery Boys meet Goodfellas. You know, it was a lot of fun, but then there was a lot of crazy stuff that went on. So that pretty much sums it up. So there they are stealing a wheelchair out of the VA hospital because the VA hospital was up the street from us and there were wheelchairs everywhere. So, you know, so they're pushing me around. I'm drinking. I'm in eighth grade. You know, we're getting drunk. You know, eighth grade graduation. Woo-hoo! You know, life is good, you know. Drinking was a sport in the Bronx. Basically was. It was used as a verb and a noun. Are you going drinking tonight? Which meant, are you getting drunk tonight? It didn't, you know, it wasn't, you know, there's nothing social about our drinking. We bought quarts of beer, we bought, you know, and then the drinking age was 18. So even when you were like 12, you had an older brother that was 16 that could go in and buy booze for you. And so, you know, you were pretty much set. And so finally when I was like 15 years old, I was able to get into the bars. And, you know, that means I arrived. You know, I'm in the, you know, in New York City there was a bar in every corner. And previous to that, you know, I was in the bars as a kid because my father used to, stop at every bar. We'd be in downtown Manhattan, and he'd stop at every bar on 3rd Avenue going home. And, you know, everyone knew him. You know, he was a big drinker, you know. And so I was familiar with bars. You know, one of my first jobs was, as a kid, I was a shine boy. We'd go into the bars because everyone wore shoes then. And right one night, Johnny Rossi would sell the Daily News because all these husbands were saying, "I'm going out for the Daily News." They had a night owl. The paper came out at night. They'd go to the bar. They would drink, and they had shoes, and they had to be shined. So he would sell the newspaper. We'd buy the paper for a dime. We'd sell it for a dollar. These guys had to cover their asses. They were alcoholics. Yeah, give me that paper, right? And shining shoes, you know. So I was always from an early age in and out of bars. And, you know, so I was familiar with it. And then, you know, finally when I was like 15, you know, you could get into the neighborhood bar. So we'd go to mass at like 7:30 and then the church would get out. And then 8:30, you're in the bar, you know. And then I'm good for another week until I go to mass again, you know. My drinking started pretty early. And it was frequent. It was not, you know. I hear people say, you know, well, I started when I was young, but I couldn't get it again until I was 18. Nah, that was not my story. Basically, it was consistent, it was flowing, and it was always there. When I was 17, I ran into a guy that gave me the magic elixir, because I was already starting to have problems with alcohol at that point. I'm starting to get blackout, I'm starting to get drunk, I'm starting to get sloppy. Well, guess what? He said, "Oh, try this stuff." What is it? Oh, it's cocaine. So it's the great elixir, you know? And I realized, oh, God, this is the greatest stuff in the world. And so I ended up, you know, doing as much cocaine as I possibly could. Then my mother died when I was 17. So at this point, basically, as I have neither of my parents alive. I'm the youngest of seven. My eldest sister at the time was 30. So, you know, in hindsight, you know, she probably should have known better. But I was on my own since that point. So I ended up, you know, making all my own bad decisions were my decisions, but all my good decisions were my decisions. God had nothing to do with my life. It was, you know, this is who I am. So, you know, there's, you know, like, so when I was 17, I get an apartment with Sal and Rob. Everyone from New York's got a friend named Sal, don't they? You know? Right. So we get an apartment, right? And so the party is on. It's the party house. We're partying all the time. I got a little bit of money from an inheritance. You know, so we decided to go down to the USS Intrepid. Does anyone know what that is? It's a museum in New York. It's an old World War II aircraft carrier, right? So I was up for a couple of days doing what I do, and then on the way down we took some Tylenols, right? So all of a sudden I get on the ship, and realize I'm starting to feel a little woozy, right? I'm like, oh, I gotta lay down, all right? So I look into the hull of the aircraft, right? And I say, you know something? I have a really good idea. I say, you know, If I can climb to the back of that and I can't see them sticking their heads in, they can't see me sleeping in there. So, you know, I figure I'm just going to lay down for an hour and, you know, let those guys, you know, explore the ship and things like that. Well, I wake up like 8 hours later, right? The ship is closed down. This thing is empty. There's nobody on it. It's dark out, right? I'm 8 stories up, right? The gangplank is gone. It's like, it's just normal life appearance, right? So I'm on top of this thing saying, hey, get me off of here, right? Some security guard comes in through the ship and says, how did you end up here? It's like I gave him some cock and bull story and, you know, and you know, he took me through the bowels of the ship and got me off at street level, you know. But, you know, the thing is, in hindsight, I'm thinking, you know, my friends might, you know, they had no concern where I went. That's the sad part of it. It was like, you know, I show back up, they're like, where were you? And I'm like, well, I was out. You know? And so they had no concern about me. So, you know, that tells you a lot. So, you know, that's one incident for my teens. So then, when I was 21, I'm sitting in Mannion's on Fordham Road. It's an Irish bar, right? And John Fitzpatrick, otherwise known as Fitzy, is sitting next to me. And two stools down is his father, John Fitzpatrick. And two stools down is his father, his grandfather, John Fitzpatrick, right? And I look at them and I see my life, right? And I said, you know, you guys are effed. I said, I'm out of here. Oh, Pierce, you're never going to leave. You know, so a couple days later, I knew there was something west of the George Washington Bridge, and I drove to California. So I get to California. I hit Sacramento, California. Right? I'm like, this is not from the, you know, early 80s movies that I pictured. So I get on I-5, and I go south, and I get to the Mexican border, and I'm like, well, I don't speak Spanish. So I lived in San Diego for about a year. Well, a couple of years, as a matter of fact. So, you know, unfortunately, that was my first geographic cure. And I've had, you know, basically there were incidences in New York where I got arrested, things like that. But you know, I was a budding alcoholic at this point, a real budding alcoholic. So I moved to San Diego, and I'm hanging out with the same people. I'm hanging out in the same dive bars. I'm hanging out in, you know, just, you know, I'm working shitty jobs, and I'm just, you know, just getting through life. You know, I'm just plugging along. Then all of a sudden, you know, I start getting an attitude. I'm like, this sucks, that sucks. You know, I'm comparing everything to New York City, right? If I want to order 5-star Indian food at 4 o'clock in the morning, why can't I have it, right? I would never order 5-star Indian food at 4 o'clock in the morning, but that's my mentality. Why isn't there this? Why isn't that? So I said, I know what my problem is. I got to move to a bigger city. So this is like 1984. So the Olympics are going on in L.A. So I'm like, oh, cool, I'm going to go to L.A. So I moved to L.A., right? It's a bigger city, right? And I still have that same mentality, right? But the place I could live was in the middle of South Central L.A. If anyone remembers South Central L.A. from the 80s, right? So I'd be out walking in the streets, and the cops would be like, what are you doing here? I was like, I live right over there, right? And then I'd be in the supermarket, and the black woman would be like, white boy, what are you doing in here? I'm like, well, I live right over here, you know? And the problem was that I grew up in such a, when you're in a pile of garbage and you don't realize it, seeing somebody with grass like they have in L.A., you're like, oh, this is a nice neighborhood. So, you know, so I lived there, you know, I lived right across the street from the L.A. Coliseum, and I was on Figueroa and Martin Luther King. You know you're in the worst part in town when you're living on Martin Luther King. And somewhere along the way when I was living in L.A., it dawned on me that New York was the exception and not the rule. And, you know, that was probably the first acceptance I ever had in my life where, okay, I can accept this, right? So then I ended up moving to Northern California for a while. And then my sister, she was going to the University of Colorado at Boulder, and she invited me out there. So I show up with a bag about this big, you know, for Thanksgiving weekend, you know, and 20 years later, I was still there. Typical alcoholic. It's like, yeah, I'm staying here. So, you know, so this is where my consequences started happening. I wasn't there probably a year, and I remember there's an area of Boulder called The Hill, and Boulder's a college town, and all the college students are hanging out up there, and it was right around Thanksgiving, and I'm driving home, and two cars behind me, I see a police car, and so that car stops, I stop, and the car in front of me stops, right, and I'm figuring, well, they're after somebody else, they're after me, I haven't done anything wrong, right, the cop gets out of the car, tells the guy behind me to leave, tells the guy in front of me to leave, and then it's just me, and it's like, oh my God, they wanted me, right, so I ended up getting my first DUI, in Colorado, right? And that was pay a fine, you know. And it's funny because here I am standing in front of a podium with a tie on. Most of my life, when I stood in front of a podium with a tie on, I was called defendant. You know? So I did what was required of me, and you know, and it wasn't that big of a deal. Not that far later, I got a second DUI. Well, guess what? The consequences get worse, you know. And now it's like, you know, they're talking about, you know, putting me in work release, and they're putting, you know, they're talking about, you know, and so I had a probation officer. Her name was Nancy Higgins, and I remember this. She tried 12-stepping me. You know, I remember this after I got sober. You know, she's like, "Do you think, you know?" But I wasn't ready to hear any of it. You know, because they never sentenced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. They sentenced me to education at first, then they sentenced me to therapy. And my attitude was, this is all just part of the punishment. They just want my money. Anyone else know that feeling? You know, and I wasn't willing to receive what they were trying to give me, but I was just part of the punishment. Then after I would go to education, because I had to go weekly, like for 50 weeks or whatever, I'd go to the bar and I'd drink and I'd bitch about it. You know, that's what I got out of the education part of it and the therapy part of it. You know, I remember the therapist telling me, because I told her, one of my big things was why I drank was I couldn't sleep. Anyone else? Well, she's like, just get into that gray area in your brain. I'm like, I don't have a gray area in my brain. So the circumstances started getting worse and worse and worse. Like, so finally, after like my fourth DUI there, they put me on, you know, they're like, okay, we had him, he went one, he went two, he was in work release, he got through that. Then he was in work release again. Like, here goes a great story. So they sentenced me to work release, right? Problem was, I didn't have a job, right? So I had some time from the time they sentenced me to the time I had to go to work release. So I got a job, right? And so I had to go talk to one of the vice presidents of the company and explain to them that the sheriff's department is going to be calling you to confirm my employment. Well, she goes to the president of the company and tells him that story. You know, I think people should be covering up for me and basically just buying into who I am. And, you know, this is no big deal. This is just, you know, who I am. And I remember the president of the company calls me in his office and he says, you know, how come this didn't come up in the interview? I said, would you have brought it up in the interview? So then I got another DUI, and this time they said, so what happens is I call my sister up. My sister's the one that's always been my enabler. She was living there, you know, basically, when she was the one bailing out of jail. She was like the one coming to get me. She was the one that, you know, when I was on work release, basically, I had it so that I was out of jail 7 days a week, and on the seventh day, it was I have to go to church, you know, and I had that all written in my schedule and things like that. So So finally, I get this last DUI, and she says, I'm not coming to get you, right? Figure it out. So I end up going back to court, and, you know, it's like, okay, I got to get out of jail. And so I end up agreeing to a year of home detention. And what that encompassed was having a breathalyzer in my house. The only problem with that was you had to have a landline for that. And I didn't have a landline, but I'm like, yeah, sure, I can do that. Right, so they put an ankle bracelet on me, and they put a breathalyzer in my house, and that breathalyzer would go off burm, 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 when I walked in. It would go off first thing at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't understand the whole thing about 8 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning when you started moving, but then I realized people, you know, if they're drinking the night before, it's going to catch them that way. And so I managed to get through that sentence, and I didn't drink that whole time, but I did a lot of drugs because the breathalyzer wasn't checking for that. And so when I finally finished my sentence, it was Memorial Day weekend. I remember I called them up and I said, listen, I'm going to come and drop this stuff off. They're like, oh, we're closed on Saturday. It's a holiday. I'm like, really? So I said, I'm cutting your bracelet off. And they said, if you cut that off, you're going to have to buy it. I'm like, okay, right? So I disconnected all their stuff. And that weekend, I started drinking again. So my sister comes over to my house, the same one, you know. She's like, Pierce, you haven't drank for a year. Why are you drinking? I said, Karen, you don't understand. It wasn't that, you know, that they were stopping me from drinking. I was counting down the days till I could drink. You know, and, you know, that was the reward for getting through all this, was drinking. So, fast forward a couple of years, you know, there's been girlfriends that came into my life, you know, fiancés, you know. I had one fiancé, Kaylee, you know, she used to call me Boozerini. That's not a good name. You know, and you know, I'd come home and I'd have a case of beer and a bottle of Jameson's, and I would take the cap off the bottle of Jameson's and I would throw it in the trash. She goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Does it look like I'm putting this back on the shelf?" You know, so I wasn't. And so, you know, my main mistress in my life was alcohol. It was my best friend. It was my, you know, my confidant. It gave me the strength that I needed. It allowed me to, you know, do things outside. Like, you don't know how many job interviews I've been on the phone where I was half in the bag. I did very well with those jobs too. But, you know, but it was just, you know, I was drunk every chance I got. And, you know, the thing was, and I didn't realize it until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. What I was doing was I was burying my feelings. You know, when I was younger, when I was a kid, I was, you know, I had shame and guilt. And shame and guilt, when you become an alcoholic and you start drinking a lot, turns into anger. You know, it manifests itself one way or the other. It manifests itself into anger with me. And, you know, I was an angry person. I'm still an angry person, but I'm getting better, I think. And, you know, I had a lot of shame and guilt. I don't know what, you know, I can't put my finger on it today. I don't know what it was, but it was the feelings I was having that I can recognize today, that it was shame and guilt that turned into anger. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons, you know, what I was drinking over was I was burying those feelings. It was, you know, I remember when I was in high school, right, and they, you know, the teacher was like, I want to talk to your father. I'm like, you can't. He'd be like, why? And I'm like, he's dead. Right? And then they're like, I want to talk to your mother. Well, you can't. Why? She's dead. And I was there to make them feel bad about it, you know? And, you know, it was, you know, so there was a lot of shame and guilt that I had as a kid that I carried on as an adult. And then I became an alcoholic. And then basically it turned into sheer anger. That's what it turns into. And I can identify those feelings now as a recovering alcoholic. But, you know, if you would ask me 10 years ago, like, you know, no, I don't identify with that. And, you know, here goes how it still manifests myself. A couple weeks ago, I was out doing a walk at like 9 o'clock at night. I live in Chamblee. And I'm sitting on the bench and I'm talking to my sister. I got earbuds in my ear and I got the phone in my hand. And, so what happens is these two guys walk up to me. One guy comes and just grabs the phone out of my hand, right? I'm 57 years old. You would think I would say, okay, well, that's no big deal. It's just a phone, right? My sister hears MF on the phone, and then the race is on. I'm chasing this guy, you know? So somewhere along the way, I don't have that flight gene in me. I got the fight gene in me, but I don't have the flight gene in me. And I need to get better at that. You know, I've had a lot of circumstances in my life where things like that happened where, you know, sometimes it's better just to walk away, and I can't. You know, so, you know, the clock's moving quick. So, you know, so finally I ended up moving to Georgia, right? Now, I was involved with this woman for eight years or so. It was a long-distance relationship, and every time I came down here, I was drinking just the way Pierce drinks. And so I ended up moving into her house, right? And everything was hers, and, you know, I had nothing, you know? And I got down here in December of 2006. Well, if you remember 2006, the economy is tanking in the ground. And for the last 10 years, I worked as a loan origination, a mortgage broker. And guess what? Trying to get back into that business, you know, to create a new business in 2006 was not the place to do it. But previous to that, I worked in technology, so I got a job. And it took me a while to get the job. I finally got it in, you know, March or April or something like that. So I was here for quite a few months. So I felt guilty about it, so I gave my first few paychecks. But meanwhile, I'm still drinking the way an alcoholic drinks. And she's getting concerned about my drinking. And so finally, you know, I gave her my paycheck, gave her my second paycheck, and, you know, I kept a few bucks for myself. I got to, you know, protect the supply somehow, you know, so I got the money. And she calls me when I'm coming home one night, and she says, all your stuff is packed, and it's in my sister's car, and she'll take you wherever you want to go. Problem was, I knew nobody in Georgia. I had a job. I didn't have a car. I didn't, you know, I really didn't know anybody. You know, I was dependent on this person, basically. And so she's driving me around to these different hotels, and I'm like, no. So I ended up basically, you know, renting a room in the Holiday Inn on La Vista Road for a month, right? And the first thing I did is liquor store next door to it. I go and I introduce myself to the guys in the liquor store. I said, I'm going to be here a lot. And, you know, so that was one of the reasons why I picked that hotel, was just, you know, the liquor store. And I, so then all of a sudden after a month, I'm like, okay, I can't afford to live in a hotel the rest of my life, right? So I ended up renting a room in somebody's house. And this worked out really well because he worked nights and I worked days. So I came home and I drank. And I drank for 3 years straight. And that's how, you know, I had a room. Like, I remember holiday weekends. So what happened was I got tired of bottles, right? So I started buying beer in the cans. And the only bottles I had were, like, bottles of booze and things like that. But they weren't clunky, right? So it'd be a holiday weekend, and I'd have a trash can filled up with cans, right? So I'm like, well, how am I going to get more beer cans in there? So I'd step on top of the trash can and pound them down, you know, just trying to make more room for it so I could drink more. And so I went to work every day, and every day I would get up, and I would swear I wasn't going to drink. I'd be like, no, I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today. About noon, I would go to lunch. I would start feeling better, right? By 3 o'clock, I'm taking inventory in my head. Do I go to the liquor store? Do I go to the bar? What do I do? You know? And by 6 o'clock that night, I am drinking again. You know, I just thought that I felt better and changed my mind all those times. I didn't realize I had to drink because basically that's what alcoholism is, the mental obsession with physical allergy. That once I start drinking, you know, when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. In this case, it was like, I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking. And then I'll say, eh, maybe I'll drink. You know, so that's the mental obsession part of this thing. And then once I start drinking, it's like, you know, I just can't have one or two. I got to have every drink that's available to me. Either I pass out, physically separated from the alcohol by going to jail or something like that, or I just straight up run out. Those are the only reasons that would ever stop me from drinking. So that job I was telling you about, I had it for about 3 years, and I ended up getting fired from that job in May of 2010. And what happened was we got a new boss, and we're all commissioned salespeople, right? And so there'd be like 20 of us standing around every Monday while a vendor would come in and train us on their latest and greatest. And I was always hungover, and I was always doing this and holding my breath this way. People didn't smell the booze coming off me, you know? And so they hired this guy as the executive vice president. He would come into these sales meetings, and then he'd start asking questions about things that already went end of life. Well, me being restless, irritable, and discontented, I told him, I said, you know, that's great you have questions, but I don't have time to learn up to put up with your learning curve. I said, you got those questions, ask them when, you know, 20 commissioned salespeople standing around. And I walked out. So then that was like in February. Then in March, I got a real resentment against him, and I called in sick for the whole month. Right? And, right, you know, I'll show them I'm not going to show up for work, and I called in sick for a whole month. And so what happened was, in that month, I was drinking the way I want to drink. And so I'm drinking 24/7, right? Well, I have stomach problems. And so I got to the point where I drank so much that my esophagus, every time I tried drinking, nothing would go down. The problem is that when your esophagus closes down, you can't breathe because you can't swallow. You got to clear your lungs somehow. And so I end up in the hospital. Now I got a note. So I go back to work, I got a note. Right? The problem is I was a salesperson. So in April my numbers didn't crash, but in May my numbers crashed. So that executive vice president I had the problem with, he ended up firing me over that. Right? So then I went home and I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And I couldn't even get sober enough to go get unemployment. That's how drunk I was. The plan that I came up with was to kill myself. And what that looked like was I was going to go get a rope from the Home Depot. I was going to hang it from the pipes in my bedroom, and I was just going to kill myself. And I had that plan for quite a few weeks. You know, the problem was with that plan was the liquor store was always closer than the hardware store. So I'd be going to the hardware store, and I'd pull into the liquor store, and okay, I'll go home and drink this, and then I'll deal with that. And I ended up, so finally it got to the point where that same sister in Colorado, the one who's been a savior to me in a lot of ways, I called her up and I said, I'm turning into, because my mother drank was she was a binge drinker. She would be in a bedroom for 2-3 weeks at a time just drinking. And then for another 3 weeks, she'd be Mary Poppins, you know. So I was turning into that. So I called my sister up and I tell her, I said, I'm turning into mom and I'm going to kill myself. Well, my sister knows me well enough to know that I'm not, you know, and anyone here that knows me knows I'm not a drama king. You know, I'm not one of these people that just say shit for the reaction. She got scared. She calls the DeKalb County Fire Department, the police department. I end up in Peachford Hospital. Anyone here been to Peachford? So I end up in Peachford Hospital, and I go there, you know, and the only thing I really had left was health insurance, and guess what, from that job. So I had the health insurance, you know. So I checked into Peachford, and then about day four they came to me and they said, you know, Pierce, you know, we're going to send you home. And I said, you know, and this was God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I looked at them and I said, I can't go home. And they're like, why can't you go home? I said, because to go home is to drink and to go home is to die. That's what was going to happen, because I still had no solution. I didn't, you know, I, you know, I knew nothing about staying sober. I knew nothing about AA. I knew nothing. I just knew that I, to go home, I was going to die. And so they ended up getting my insurance company to extend a few days, and then I ended up going into a halfway house. And so that halfway house, my sister found it because it was, she knew where I lived, and she called on the phone and she spoke to them and she paid the upfront fees and things like that. So about 3 weeks into it, the director calls her up and says, "Oh, I'm just going to give you a report on Pierce." And so she's like, "Okay." So he's there. So he gives the report and says, "Yeah, he's doing better, blah, 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 blah." He says, "Oh, by the way, it's going to be $5,000 a month for him to stay here, right?" So my sister says, "Well, that's great, but you need to talk to Pierce about that." You know, she was having no part of that. You know. So me and the director sat down and we talked about a realistic number, and it wasn't $5,000 a month. And what they did was they took me to a lot of meetings. I remember sitting in the back of this meeting when I was new, and I'd sit in the back row, and it's the 11 o'clock meeting, and people are getting up and getting coffee and walking around, and one guy's pointing at people, "Hey, you need coffee?" And I'm sitting there saying, "Don't these people realize I'm trying to get sober?" Right? So I call my sponsor up, and I'm bitching about this. I'm like, "You know, you cannot believe these people are not sitting down and doing, you know, they're there for coffee, they're there for every other reason but to get sober." So he says to me, he says, "Well, why don't you just change your seat? That's why it's good having a sponsor. They have a different view on things." You know? So I changed my seat, and here I am. So one of the things they did at that halfway house was they made me get a sponsor. And, you know, and I had a laundry list of what a sponsor should be. Basically, was it's got to be somebody that's smarter than I am, that's gone through things that I haven't gone through, that, you know, drank, you know, there was a situation in life camp that they didn't drink over that I could gloss onto. So I heard this guy telling his story over, we used to go to Petrie Hospital on Wednesday nights, and I heard him telling his story, and the halfway house was giving me pressure because we'd stand around the room every night at 10 o'clock, and they'd be like, "Pierce, you got a sponsor?" And it's like, "No." You know, then it would, you know, so finally it was like, "Yes, I got a sponsor," just to get them off, right? So this gentleman actually did something very good for me, and I don't know if anyone here is in a halfway house, but he broke me away from that pack mentality. He came and he picked me up, and we sat down behind the church that the home group was meeting in, and we started working the steps. We were going through it word by word, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, we read where it said read, and we wrote where it said wrote, and we prayed where it said prayed. So then I was on my fourth step, and I just left that halfway house. I'm living in a three-quarter house down on Buford Highway here, because basically it was, you know, they say, you know, you need a sufficient substitute for your drinking. And also, so the halfway house filled in for the sufficient substitute for that while I was there. But then there were things I wanted to do in AA that the halfway house was interfering with. So I moved into a three-quarter house. The people in that three-quarter house were doing crazy stuff. They were getting drunk. They were doing drugs. They were being housed there. There was a lot of things going on. But I wanted to get sober. And I came to this meeting. I came to the Biscayne room. I came to my home group. I lived in AA in the first year. In the first year, people say, "Oh, go to 90 meetings in 90 days." I probably went to 1,500 meetings in the first year, if not more. I got involved in my home group. I was doing service work. I was, at this point. So the sponsor I had, so I'm in the middle of my fourth step. And so he comes to me sometime, I think it was in December. I got sober, or November or December, and I got sober in June. So I was like 4 or 5 or 6 months sober, something like that. And he says to me, he says, "Pierce, I'm moving." I'm like, "Okay, you know, people move." And I think, you know, I got, you know, we got time to get through this, you know. He goes, "No, you don't understand, I'm moving tonight." I'm like, "Oh, shit." So what happens is, so I just left the halfway house I was in. I'm living in a three-quarter house, right? I'm at one of those crossroads in my life where, do I continue what I'm doing, or do I say, "I got this, I can handle life going forward," right? So that night, I asked another man to be my sponsor. I really didn't know him very well. I heard him share from the podium. I liked what he had to say. And probably within 3 weeks, I was doing the fifth step at his house with him. And, you know, he's been my sponsor ever since. You know, and, you know, he met all my requirements and more, except I didn't know it. Because, you know, and, and that's the reason why I'm still sober. It's my network of friends that I have in AA, but more importantly, it's my sponsor. When you know what hits the fan, he's the guy I go to. So here goes a great story about him. So last December, I lost my job again, right? So at this point, basically, I've been sober now eight and a half years or so. You know, I have things now. I got a new car. I got a house. I got things like that. You know, my life has gotten better. So I see my sponsor and I say, you know, I need to go to the psychiatrist and get Xanax. He said, what do you need to go to the psychiatrist? I said, you know, I think this is anxiety I have now. I don't know where I got it, but I got anxiety. I learned anxiety from you guys in AA. So his response is, he goes, why don't you go home and do an inventory, a fear inventory, right? So I said, okay, I'll give that a shot. So I go home and I start writing, you know. And, you know, I'm like, how's this going to help me? And as I'm writing this, I'm texting him, you SOB, you knew what, you know, right? Because that's just it. Is your sponsor knows better than you do. Basically, my solution was to get a chemical, you know, enhancer, which would have been Xanax or something like that. And I'd be popping those things like Chiclet right now as I'm speaking to you guys. But like, yeah, everything's good. Life's wonderful. You know? Yeah. Just chill out, man. So I did that. I got through it, and it was funny because, you know, the fear wasn't losing what I, you know, the fear wasn't, you know, the fear of what I figured out the fear was, it was the fear of losing what I have, which is a totally different fear than I came in here with. All I had to do was pay my rent when I got here. You know, now I'm afraid of losing stuff. So we got through that, and then, you know, then I started doing a job search this year, you know, and it was humbling, you know. I work in sales. I work in, you know, in medical sales, dentistry to be exact, and I've had quite a few jobs in that. And so I'm interviewing with all these companies, and, you know, the first interview, the second interview, but then I never hear back. Like, I have one company fly me to California, interview me, fly me back home, put me up in a hotel, and I still haven't heard from them, you know. So, you know, and, you know, here's a humbling experience. So when I was living in Colorado, I picked up a felony along the way, right? So I decided, okay, I need some income coming in. So I apply to Uber. Uber, I'm driving my own car. I'm an independent contractor, right? So they run a background check on me, right? And it wasn't all the DUIs they were concerned about. They were concerned about that felony from 1993. I'm like, what's, you know, so I can't even get a job where I'm an independent contractor. So this is how God works in my life. So about 3 years ago, I left a company to go work at another company. And my old boss calls me up and he says, Pierce, you know, he goes, I don't know what you're doing now, you know, and I didn't tell him what I was doing, you know. So he says, you know, I have a job and, you know, the company you worked for 3 years ago is a different company now. It's a software company. He goes, I think you'd be good at it. You know, would you want to come talk to me about it? So I said, so he's there, you know, can you come in on Thursday? I said, how about Tuesday? Because it's like on Monday. I'm like, yeah, I can get in tomorrow. I'll clear my calendar for you. And So I met with him. I met with the team leader. You know, we sat down. You know, we came to an agreement. And, you know, and I've been there ever since. So, you know, that's how God works in my life, basically, is because I got to the point where I was, you know, just praying to God, please, 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 please. I was begging. It was like, get me something. And here comes this just totally out of left field. That's how God works in my life. I see God in the rearview mirror. God doesn't talk to me directly. He talks to me through you guys. He talks to me through old bosses calling me up saying, Pierce, I have no idea what you're doing, but I think you're going to be good at this. You know, that's how God works in my life today. You know, I've had bottoms in sobriety. You know, I've had, and that was one of them. You know, but no matter what, I never drank. It was, you know, I when I was first getting sober, you know, my goal was just not to drink. Like, here goes another story where my home group, we used to have go have a meeting, a big meeting on Saturday nights. We have a speaker meeting, and then we'd go have pizza, and then we'd go bowling. Well, so this is a July day like today. It was hot, you know. So, and I have, you know, I'm sober now over a year. So I go walking into the bowling alley, right? And all these guys from my home group are there, right? And I walk in, and the only thing I can focus on is those big cauldrons of beer they have, you know that they serve in bowling alleys, right? The bubbles are going up, the connotation's going down. I get the obsession to drink, right? So it's like, okay, this is not a good thing right now. This is God doing for me what I can't do myself. At least he put me surrounded by people that weren't going to let me drink. So I go to this guy, Steve R., and I said, Steve, I want a drink. And he goes, yeah, we all do. Steve was sober 17 years at this point. You know, it's like, what do you mean we all do? And, you know, he thought I meant, you know, so he didn't realize I wanted to drink to that point. So then he starts teasing me. He's like, watch, they're not going to finish it. Sure enough, they didn't finish that cauldron, you know. Then he's like, you know, if we were all drinking, we'd have one cauldron each lined up for us. I'm like, son of a bitch. Right? You know, So what happened was I stayed out, and I stayed out late enough where I could not buy any alcohol. I was the next morning I got up and I called my sponsor and I said I'm doing A, B, C, D, and E. And his response was, he says, Pierce, that's all great. He says, what are you doing in step 6, step 7, and step 11? God was nowhere in my program at that point. I was busy, involved in the fellowship. I was busy involved in the actions, but I wasn't busy in the part with God. And so since that time, I've had a better relationship with God because basically as I invited him into my life. And that's the miracle of this program was that, A, that I didn't act on that impulse, because if I would have drank that night, I'd probably be dead right now, and I didn't. And then I had the fortitude to basically call my sponsor up the next morning because and I'm still talking about it because it still bothers me, the reaction I had to it. I wasn't expecting it. It was just, I'm sober a year. And it just came out of left field. It was like, I was just at an AA meeting. I just had pizza with you guys. And here I am thinking about drinking. How does that happen? And, I have one white chip. I was 48 years old when I got here, and I'm proud of that. I am, but I did a lot of my I didn't come in when I was 20. I didn't come in when I was 30. I didn't come in when I was in my early 40s. I finally got my ass kicked enough where I showed up when I was 48 years old, when basically I had the desperation of a dying man because I was dying. That was the solution I had, was to kill myself. And, I really, enjoy, the life I have today. It's not a perfect life, but it's a better life than I've ever had. And with that, thank you all so much, and have a good night.
Thank you so much for your share tonight, and for talking about steps 6, 7, and 11 reminded me of this message that I heard, like a speaker tape from Sandy B. Some people may know, when he said, the chapter We Agnostics, we can sum it up in three words: change your mind.
So fast.